Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Nau mai, haere mai. I'm John McDonald, kia ora, and welcome into the Community Drive Hut Zone on Thursday, the 30th of April. The Hut Zone is Wellington Access Radio's weekly look into the poems, stories, people, history and music that make the Hutt Valley community. Tonight we meet the soloist at Sunday's Hutt Valley Orchestra's Wings of Fire concert, Hutt violinist Ambrose Tarrant Matthews. We chat about the concert, Ambrose's musical studies and his hopes for the future as a classical performer. We conclude our series from the Hutt Library's Heritage Collection on Eastbourne and the Waihini disaster with Bruce Mitchell. And there's a poem from the 2022 Upper Hutt Library Poetry Competition called Home by Kimmy Thompson. And we have music from tonight's guest, Ambrose Tarrant Matthews, and also from Upper Hutt Brass Band from this month's national competition. Let's start the show with the 2012 history series of interviews with Eastbourne residents who were involved in the rescues of the 10th of April 1968 when the Waihini ferry sank. Bruce Mitchell, aged 18 at the time, shares his memories for the final time with Hutt City Council's Shelley Say.
I walk along the beaches thinking of another day. Sea so calm and gentle now, as if to draw my thoughts away from the anger that it vent on that sad and faded ship, Waihine.
You've been very forthcoming how the disaster, Waihini disaster, affected you at the time and also during the tribunal. Long term, how do you think it's affected Bruce Mitchell?
A hard one. The main interests that I've taken, the likes of education and things, aren't related to this. I didn't take up search and rescue or anything like that. No. I think I certainly benefited from it. It didn't do me any harm. I've done a lot of different things over the years. Yeah, it's probably given a lot of confidence, in doing things. I mean, like running around Europe at the age of 21 on a motorbike on your own and finding, like one guy stuck a 12-gun shotgun in my thing. I won't have no gypsies on my land, German policemen who think they need to point a gun at you because you're cooking some frankfurters at 11 o'clock at night in a motorway. But yes, probably I could take all of those things in my stride because they weren't big events, and I probably encountered a lot more than other people because you just wait on. This concept that I felt that day of how much life someone has in them. You are very conscious of how much life you've got in yourself and what you can actually do, I've have a lot of satisfaction from things that I've taken on, blindly perhaps or whatever, I mean, this building here, in terms of building it, I designed and built my own house, but I built a lot of underground service buildings for local authorities and things. But this building was quite special. I just didn't hesitate in taking it on. There was no build-up to it or anything. This was just whack, bam, this needs to be done. How are we going to do it? Boom, right, I'll organise that.
It can be done.
I think I definitely benefited from the experience, but I had also benefited from our general activity, the family activities and boats and things. But it gave me a bit of a feeling, I've probably said before, of how much of a pounding people can take. And it's also made me very conscious of the number of people that don't have that strength. So I don't know. Perhaps these are normal things or not, but they're things I notice. I have been involved in helping a lot, especially people who get into scraps. Now, this could be related to my experience with the police event or anything. I have a very, very, very strong sense of fair play. I have gone into bat for people in all sorts of different circumstances. We have a rare thing here. We have a one-sided pylon route. I got into an argument with Transpower about what they were allowed to do and weren't allowed to do. And much to Transpower's disgust, they got half of what they wanted to do. But, you know, I sued Fletcher Challenge, and I had a disagreement with the tax department, which Sir Thomas Eichelbaum formed an impression of. Mm. And things. So, you know, I don't take rubbish. I wouldn't say I'm intolerant.
It's a fairness.
It's a fair play. There was a guy running an auctioneer's business, and my mother died, and I wanted to get rid of the goods. And he wanted to choose what goods he took and didn't. And he drove off without telling me. He didn't give me a receipt, as he's required to do. He wouldn't give me a receipt until 3 or 4 days. He chose that some stuff would go into an antiques auction, and I wanted the money out, boom, done. He wouldn't pay me afterwards. He said I'd get paid on the 20th of the following month. So I told him the Auctioneers Act made certain requirements, and I got nowhere. You know? Mm. So when the 31st of March came round and those little adverts appear as they do, calling for objections to the Auctioneers Act, I went into the Lower Hutt Court to get a form for objection. And Lower Hutt Court doesn't have a form for objection to auctioneer. In fact, nobody had a form for objection to.
You just had these little advertisements.
I found a form actually. It's at the back of the 1908 Act, and lodged an objection. The auctioneer made a lot of improvements to his business, and in the end I withdrew my objection, much to the disgust of the judge, who had formed an impression of what the result might be. and the enthusiasm of opposing counsel. I was appearing for myself, I'm not a counsel. I was just, yeah. But anyway, he got all eager and said that he wanted to be heard on costs, and she turned around and said, "You have got to be joking." Yeah. I don't think I was like that before. Very, very strong sense of fair play, and probably just a general enjoyment of life. I mean, I choose the bits I like quite clearly and avoid the bits I don't. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you become a bit of a hero in the community?
No, I don't know that the story really got out. Well, I was Wellington College, and there were only, you know, small handful of us, you know.
Yeah. Were you officially thanked?
No, I've never been officially thanked by anybody.
Do you think you should have been?
No, I don't. It was something I chose to do. Nobody asked me to. Nobody said there was a need. You know, I just stuck my nose in. And, yeah, I didn't expect thanks, but I didn't expect to feel intimidated by a group of policemen on the front doorstep at 8:30 on a Sunday night, no.
Has that ever been addressed in any shape or form?
No, not formally, no.
Would you like it to be?
No, I don't think so. If somebody hears my recording and they know who it is, they know exactly what I'm talking about. So it's up to them how they feel. Yeah.
Would you ever want this story to be told about the intimidation?
Quite clearly in signing the preface to this, I don't have any objection to anything that I've said. You know, it's fact. I'll stand up in any corner of the land. So it's really quite simple.
Okay. Now, if we move away, and then with the effect on you, enormous, understandably, and thankfully, it wasn't negative.
Hmm.
The community, what did you notice the effect on the community, or the impact on the community? We've got the initial impact where they thanked everybody and there were complaints about the police. But overall, what do you think?
Yeah, I was certainly conscious of people who had gripes with this or that or whatever. You know, I mean, there were some people who didn't get their shoes back, you know, and things. None of that mattered, you know. I probably didn't dwell on the thing particularly myself.
I mean, were they more safety conscious? Was there an increased community feeling at all? Was there an anticlimax?
There could have been an anticlimax in that different people's experiences and things, you know, not being dealt with. I was very, very lucky that I encountered John Craig at Wellington College. Mm. And I can look back on that and say that that guy did me the biggest favour in my life, because I could have ended up a total screwball. That I was very, very conscious when the plane hit Erebus, and the trauma counselling given to the, or whatever was given to the guys who went down there. You know, they were trained professionals and whatever, and they went there. I might have a little hurt that I didn't expect and didn't need and anything else, any thanks from anybody or whatever. But for, yeah, even the acknowledgement, I'm not worried about that. But if there were people in the community or authority who recognised that the people who were around that coast that day needed some help, then that help wasn't offered.
Okay, so what would you advise if you were going to say, look, I was there, did that, moved on, this is what needs to be done next time?
Pretty hard day to plan. Everybody had different experiences. Yep. There were things blowing off their roofs or down the road or whatever, or somebody had gone to the hut and couldn't get back or whatever, right? So everyone had their own problems. I just happened to have a delight in the coast and the sea and the bush and all of those things. And I chose to get involved. In terms of getting prepared or not, I mean, they couldn't have planned for it. Could they have reacted in any other way? I think what we really had was a natural reaction. Those individuals from Eastbourne who sensed the thing the same way I did, and went around there, there was no other reason they were there. You know, they went there for exactly the same reason, you know, and independently.
They knew,
whether they were just to see going there to see it happen, they knew that was the place to be. And fortunately for those people, they weren't stopped. Now, it is unfortunate that others who tried to go around there were stopped. I can understand the police making a judgment on whether to protect people from what they could have encountered around there. And it might be pretty hard for them to filter out who could cope with that or not. Yeah, yeah. But if for instance, and they may have done it, I didn't bother to go, but if they'd had a community meeting and the police had said something like that, hey, look, you know, not only do we want to thank the people that opened the bar at the RSA, you know, but, you know, we want to thank the people that went around the coast and you know, it was a difficult call for us, but we knew of the extent of the tragedy there and that we needed to manage it in a professional manner or something, then they wouldn't have alienated people in the community. There seemed to be a bit of an alienation. I didn't give a stuff, but, you know, a lot of people must have felt.
Still do.
Okay, yeah. And the police behave the way the police behave, and they think the way the police do. Well, they still do today. There's odd things I see at times where I think, yeah, the police can't stop themselves, you know, doing things in this manner. There's not that imagination, not much imagination in it. But anyway, I would never be a policeman.
So you're saying that, and correct me if I'm wrong in my interpretation, that if the police had openly communicated after the event with the community, it would have alleviated a lot of negativity.
I think so. I mean, you know, the only thing I was conscious of is what I regarded as the PR job.
Yeah.
Of, you know, that was at
there wasn't the, any.
No, that was at the expense of people who did very well on the day. You know, to make, I don't know if the comment was made, but the impression was certainly formed that, you know, that there are people in the community that take advantage of a situation like this. You know, that sticks in my mind for some reason, to cause trouble for the police sort of thing. That was completely and utterly 1,000% out of line. That was not what happened at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody had been around the coast and had experienced that, they were traumatised.
Yeah.
You know, help them, don't blame them, you know. But the police are the police, and I think the public have got to recognise also that it's they've got a job that those particular members of the public anyway wouldn't want to take on. There are results of the environment that they work in. Yeah, and not all of the decisions they make are brilliant.
It can't be.
But, you know, as long as they keep getting up the next day, right?
As long as we've still got them. Yep. There is also some comments that have come through too, and I'd be interested in whether you've got any opinion on it, that there are certain members of the community, and none have been named, that took advantage of the situation to be spokespeople when they were not qualified or experienced to be a spokesperson. Did you observe anything like that?
No, I didn't, but a good question in light of my experience and going to one civic function where an ex-policeman made a big thing of having been around the coast himself, and I know that he was not one of the group of people who were there in the first instance, that he could only have been one of the ones who followed up in a supportive role after the event, mm-hmm. because... Basically, in terms of getting all the people out of the water, it was mainly that small group of 10 people who got the bulk of those people out of the water. If those people hadn't have been there, the death toll would have been 10 times, you know, three times as much. You know.
Yeah.
Really quite scary, because those people just couldn't get out of the water.
No.
You know, and they were fortunate that the people who were there were able-bodied people of a similar age, you know, the right age. You know, I was one of the younger ones, but, you know, 22, 24, you know, yeah.
And the confidence in the water.
Yeah, that's it. You
know, yeah, and very, the knowledge very, of the
water. Yes, yeah, that put them there, you know. Yeah. And even the raw recruit police and the other two, you know, they did incredibly well. You know.
So there were no... recruits standing around just watching
them. No. Those were there. You couldn't hang around. You couldn't. I mean, there's somebody there getting sloshed backwards and forwards out of the water. You just, you know, would take somebody out and prop them up on above the high tide line, as we thought it was, you know, and then you go back for the next one and you try and get this person. And this one's got caught by a wave, moved 4 feet, and gets caught by the next wave and dragged back in again, you know, and the fear and their face of going back into the water, you know.
And you needed people just to look after those people there.
No, you couldn't look after, we couldn't look after them. All we could do was dump them. And people were just walking off in a daze, those that could. And there were comments about people climbing the hills. I don't believe anyone climbed the hill. Maybe somebody did. To me, it's almost fiction. I mean, these people had trouble putting one foot in front of the next and absolutely climbing over the rocks. They weren't walking on a road. No.
There was no road to walk on.
Nah, it had been washed away totally, you know, completely and utterly. Yeah.
And you got as far as you could on that. So... there are a few people that you have observed that spoke out of turn, perhaps from their own experience.
Oh, yes, and there've been a few things that you can easily recognise that somebody's experience doesn't fit with your experience, but that doesn't discount the thing. But when you get somebody in public telling a story and embellishing it a fair bit and saying, well, see that pipe up there with the black stain on the cliff above it, this is Pencarrow, you know, that's where the lighthouse keeper used to do the fog warnings by throwing dynamite into the hole. I felt like putting my hand up and saying, look, please, sir, isn't that the anti-siphon pipe for the sewage pumping station? Yeah. and that same person had been telling us about, you know, somebody being rescued.
Last couple of questions. What made you want to contribute to this particular research? I think you've answered it in the timing of it. You've spoken about David Lomax.
Yes. And also, I mean, you came across very well to me in terms of it being a community project, or, you know, focused on the community and the community's experience. And that's a totally different angle to the others. I think that's quite important. I think the community was quite traumatised by the event. There was nothing they had control over it at all, and felt it very personally, if a community can feel things personally. You know. It's easy to see they had strong opinions and have held strong opinions. It was pretty traumatic event on the doorstep. You know, I mean, I could quite easily have had a feeling of being hard done by or disadvantaged or whatever. That could easily have evolved naturally from it. But no, you know, I got it off my chest. You know, getting it off my chest a couple of times since has been good.
No, it's a matter of what we can learn from it for the community today.
Quite simply, my response would be that on a human side, irrespective of the circumstances or whatever, when anybody feels traumatised, certainly my experience with Johnny Craig is that they need to get it off their mind. They need to talk about it. It's not going to go away. They're not going to live with it with balance unless they get it off their mind.
Quite old and long, let tears begin. And loved ones lost, but save a thought for other men. On mighty oceans tossed, Wahine, Wahine.
I'm John McDonald, and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. And it was Bruce Mitchell sharing his memories of Wahine Day with Hutt City Council's Shelley Say. It was recorded in 2012. Thank you to the library for making the interview available on the Recollect platform. Let's hear the poetry reading of the week. It's from the 2022 Upper Hutt Libraries Poetry Competition.
I'm Arlene Croft. I'm reading a poem by Kimi Thompson. It's called Home. No walls, no door, no tiled floor, no wood fire in the storm. It's the way you call me mum that makes me feel warm. Your eyes, your hair, the way you care, your entire unique soul. It's the way I call you son that makes my heart whole. Your hand in mine, our eyes, they shine. The feeling of being home, it's the way you are my world, wherever we may roam.
And that was Home by Kimi Thompson, read by Trentham's Arlene Croft. Time for our feature story of the week. I saw that the Hutt Valley Orchestra is giving its first concert of the year on Sunday at St. James's Anglican Church in Lower Hutt, and I thought it would be good to hear about the afternoon's concert from one of the musicians.
My name's Ambrose Tarrant Matthews, and I've been chosen to play Mozart Concerto No. 4 with the Hutt Valley Orchestra on Sunday. Well, I got chosen from a competition in last year, I believe it was October. I won the concerto...
You were the most outstanding competitor at the Hutt Valley Performing Arts competition. Yeah, right. What was involved in that competition?
That was a 20-minute repertoire list that... You know, a few people came up with. I performed Saint-Saëns Violin Concerto No. 3, first movement, Mozart Violin Concerto No. 4, first movement, which is the one that I got picked to play, and Bach Fugue, G minor Fugue.
How did the piece with the Hutt Valley Orchestra come about? Who made that selection?
I was actually the one who chose Mozart No. 4. There was a little bit of back and forth between which concerto to pick, but in the end, I decided that Mozart 4 would be the best fit, and I really like it. So,
what made you think it was going to be the best fit? Why did you think that?
I always think that Mozart, you know, really shows off the... It's a very, like, clear sound you need for Mozart, which I believe fits really well with the repertoire that they're playing also.
What else have they got on the program for this Sunday? Are you involved in that at all?
I'm not completely involved in that. I haven't sat in many rehearsals, but I believe they have a Glinka piece and a Ritchie, I believe. Oh, and a Kachaturian.
It's all part of their Wings of Fire program. Yeah. Well, do you know why they've called it that?
I think that it's a very kind of fiery program, I believe, and my Mozart fits in quite well with that theme.
Have you done it before?
I have played the concerto before, but not with an orchestra, no.
Because it looks like you've just done the Wellington String Academy Autumn Workshop, and that was part of that covered in there, was it?
Yeah, that was. I played the first movement. That's part of the Wellington String Academy, which is a kind of project started by Helena Pohl and Lindley Culliford and a few others. And basically, it's violin and strings. I guess you could call it like school, basically. And they put on occasional workshops and extravaganzas, which is like concerts that all of the students play in, which I'm a part of and very happy to be a part of.
And was part of this performance with that academy that's just been a sort of a build-up ready for playing with the Hutt Valley Orchestra, was it?
Yeah. It helped me a lot to get my Mozart to where it is for the concert on Sunday. The tutelage from Helena and Anna van der Zee really helped me prepare it to play with an orchestra, because it's a different experience entirely playing it with an orchestra to a piano, and their tutelage really helped me with that.
Well, yeah, what is the big differences between the piano and an orchestra?
Well, playing with piano is a lot. You know, piano is only one person, right? And an orchestra, I don't even know how many. So you've kind of got to connect with so many more people when you're playing with an orchestra. And it can be a lot more tricky. But it's also rewarding in a lot more aspects.
Mm. The Hutt Valley Orchestra, then, how are the rehearsals going with them? How's that coming out?
Well, when the rehearsals aren't being cancelled because of a storm, it's going great. Yeah, they're sounding great. I'm really looking forward to it.
When did you start rehearsing with them?
The first rehearsal I had was on, I think, the 5th of April, but they had been preparing it since before then, and I've got another rehearsal with them tonight, which I look forward to.
So who's the conductor for this concert?
Donald Armstrong.
Have you worked with Donald before?
I have, yeah. I've known him since I was a little kid. My sister actually learnt from him for quite a while, so, yeah.
What advice is he giving you for the performance?
Well, he helped me a lot with kind of tightening up my rubato in sections, so I don't kind of run away from the orchestra. And, you know, he's really he's been very supportive, which I respect.
Your approach to this performance, then, talk us through that. How have you started, and how have you been preparing for it?
I suppose I've been playing with a piano for so long to where I kind of I struggled a lot with finding, you know, the connection with one person versus a whole orchestra, and tightening up a lot of places that the orchestra couldn't really follow me with, which is to no fault of their own, of course. But that's really been a big point in my preparation.
What is your practice schedule for this?
Well, this isn't the only thing I have on right now, but I try to get through every movement every day. Well, just solo preparation, I try and get at least an hour, maybe 2 hours every day on it.
Memorizing of it, how do you approach that?
Well, memorizing Mozart is actually, in my opinion, a little easier than other composers, although there are a few kind of pitfalls that I can fall into, which are tricky. But I've had the first movement for like over a year now, so the memorization for that is pretty set in stone, hopefully, touch wood.
Yeah. And you did obviously the thing at St. Andrews on the Terrace, the Academy. Mm-hmm. That was by memory too, wasn't it?
That was by memory, yes.
When did you first start with your music there, Ambrose? When did it all begin for you?
Well, I started piano at the age of about 3 and violin maybe when I was about 5. But I first started tutelage under Gillian Bibby, who is now deceased. And I overtook violin for piano at maybe about 10. And yeah, really took a holding to violin and have since stopped my piano adventures.
Why the preference for the violin? What made you do that switch?
Well, my sisters played a big part in it. They were, both my sisters at the time were more into violin than piano. So I got a lot more of that, you know, into my brain at a young age and kind of took a hold of it.
What orchestras have you played with in your time?
Yeah, well, I frequent the Wellington Youth Orchestra. I've been a member there for maybe about four years now. And I've played in the National Youth Orchestra twice, again, playing this year for the third time, one of which I was concertmaster in. Also some kind of miscellaneous orchestras that I've been a part of, you know, through Suzuki camps and Wellington String Academy.
Have you done stuff with the Hutt Valley Orchestra before?
I don't believe so, no. Maybe when I was a tiny kid, but I couldn't tell you.
Right. Now, I see you've been one of the emerging artists with the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra for the last 2 years. What does that involve?
Yeah, well, that is it's a fun program. Basically, you audition and you get to play a movement of a symphony with the New Zealand Orchestra. So that's really fun. I played that in 2025 and 4, I believe.
How did that opportunity come about? What's involved in getting yourself onto that program?
You audition online and then receive some tutelage and a few lessons from some members within the orchestra. In 2025, I was with Alan Molina.
What sort of experiences has it given you?
Well, it was a great experience playing with such a high-level orchestra. You know, it's the standard required is really helps me. And just getting some, you know, really fine details and orchestral works is, you know, a rare opportunity for me.
Who's been some of the tutors? You've mentioned your starting one. Who else have you had been tutored over the years?
Well, my current violin teacher is Elena Pohl. And before that, I was with Lindley Culliford for the first maybe 12 years, 11 years of my violin playing journey. And now I'm with Helena for the last about 2 years.
Now, you mentioned you've got some other things on the go and that the concert's not the only thing. What else have you got on at the moment then, Ambrose?
Well, I'm preparing to get some auditions ready to go overseas with, hopefully, audition for some overseas universities. So for that, I'm preparing this Mozart to a further degree. And also Sibelius Violin Concerto, some Bach, some Paganini, a whole kind of roster, really.
Where are you at as far as schooling and universities goes? What age are you?
Well, I'm 18, but I'm still just finishing up school this year and then auditioning for some schools in Australia, England, America, all around, and then hopefully leaving next year to study.
All right. Whereabouts are you based? Are you based in the Hutt at all?
I am based in the Hutt right now, but I actually am living in around Seatoun.
And what about your schooling? Were you schooled in the Hutt?
I'm actually homeschooled, so I was with Takuta.
Okay.
I'm with Takuta.
Right.
Yes.
Did you do any other activities in the Hutt Valley other than your music stuff, or is that all pretty encompassing?
No, the music stuff is pretty encompassing, but I have been doing competitions in the Hutt since I was a very, very young boy. Me and my sisters.
Yeah. So your plans then, you're obviously looking at university studies, and what would that be specializing in?
That would be violin.
Violin performance there.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. And then where's your hopes after that? Where's your sort of your long-term plans?
Well, I hope to be a concert violinist would be great, as everyone does. But I'm also open to chamber music and orchestral playing long-term.
Are there any performers that you particularly are inspired by?
Well, I've always been inspired by Haderlich. I believe he's a great player. And my sisters were also a driving force in my kind of, you know, they really influenced me to become the violinist I am today.
As far as the Sunday's concerts, that's at the St. James Church in Lower Hutt. Have you played there before?
I haven't played in them, but I have I have watched them, but this will be my first time playing.
And is the rehearsals there, or you're not rehearsing there yet?
No, we're rehearsing at St. Mark's right now.
Your message then, Ambrose, to Hutt Zone Radio listeners on coming along to support Sunday's concert, what would that message of encouragement be?
Well, I suppose I hope that you guys have as much of a good time listening as we all at the Hutt Valley Orchestra enjoyed preparing the repertoire. And yeah, hope to see you there.
I'm Joe McDonald, and you're in the Hutt Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. And that was Ambrose Tarrant Matthews talking about Sunday's Hutt Valley Orchestra's Wings of Fire program. It features Glinka's Spanish Overture No. 1, Anthony Ritchie's Albatross in Flight, Cacciatorian's Spartacus Suite No. 2, as well as Ambrose playing Mozart's Violin Concerto No. 4 in D major K218. Now, earlier in April, Ambrose performed this piece with pianist Gabriela Galapska, and here they are performing the Allegro movement together.
Thank you.
That was Ambrose Tarrant Matthews on violin with Gabriella Klapska performing the Allegro from Mozart's Violin Concerto No. 4, which Ambrose will perform in entirety on Sunday the 3rd of May, 3 p.m. at St. James's Church, Lower Hutt, with the Hutt Valley Orchestra this time. Tickets are from Eventfinder and you can get cash sales at the church door as well. But sadly, that's our radio show for this week. Thanks to all my guests tonight, and a big thank you to you for listening to the show and supporting Wellington Access Radio. You can always listen again to the show as a podcast on the Hutt Zone pages of accessradio.org.nz. If you have a suggestion of a Hutt story or a piece of musical poetry, then please do message us, either on Facebook, John McDonald NZ, or email the team, and our email is thehuttzone@outlook.co.nz. Let's go out with music from Upper Hutt Brass Band, which they played at this month's National Band Championships. It's the last movement in When the Light Falters. Until next Thursday, mate wā e noho oru mai rā. Stay well. Thank you.
The program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.